All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome to part 8 of the series The Law and the Law. Is Kilo versus City of New London, Connecticut, and the Torah's view of private property rights. Sponsored, as always, by Becky Avikatz, Le'ili Nishmas, Yonah ben Rabaye Leib. So this is one of the most controversial and critical cases to emerge from the Supreme Court in decades, but it's really largely unknown outside a small group of interested parties, because the issues discussed in the case revolve around what is one of the most fundamental rights of any person, and that's the right to own property and the right to maintain control of that property. Such a right is at the core of freedom. One basic freedom we have is economic freedom, which is the right to earn your own income, to keep what you have, except for certain societal needs that the government will take, and especially the right not to have your property confiscated by the government. Apropos of this, I hope many of you saw in today's Wall Street Journal an op-ed column by my good friend Rabbi Aryeh Spiro, who wrote on what the Bible has to teach about capitalism, and was very, very well done. But the right, this right of property ownership, was so fundamental and so at odds with the common practices of ancient and medieval kings that the protection of private property was enshrined in the Constitution in the less famous part of the famous Fifth Amendment. Of course, the famous part deals with non-incrimination, self-incrimination. But the less famous part states, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. That is to say, the king, the government, has no right simply to take your property because he or it wants it. Nonetheless, this clause has to subtly navigate another basic right of government, the right of eminent domain. There are occasions when the government needs a person's land for some public use, some use that will benefit the general public, even as it inconveniences a person or smaller group. Part of the rights of the sovereign is that it can confiscate, the legal term is condemn, private property, most commonly to use for public utilities or railroads or highways, some public use, as the Constitution states. Public progress often comes at the expense of private concerns. That's the way it is. But the Constitution's guarantee was that eminent domain would be applied, quote, for public use, and that, quote, just compensation, unquote, would be provided the owners. Now, obviously, just compensation would always be an issue. What is it worth? You can't always put the value in money. But at least there was a metric that could be utilized, property value. Indeed, a home might have more value being sold to a rapacious government for less than its value before the government builds a highway around it and the value drops precipitously. The crucial question we will deal with is not just compensation, but what is considered public use. This was James Madison's phrase, chosen very carefully, public use, instead of, for example, public benefit or public interest. Those phrases were also discussed. They're much more broad than is public use. Public use was the one in the Constitution, the Fifth Amendment. Of course, the phrase itself was somewhat vague. What is included or excluded from public use? But that was the subject of Kilo. New London, Connecticut is a port city in the southeast part of the state. What part are you from?
Hartford,
right. Remember, you all remember probably Faye Foreman. She was a native of New London, Connecticut. So New London's the home not only of Faye, but also the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, and it's not far from Groton, where the Navy has a large submarine base. Interestingly, both Nathan Hale and John McCain lived there for a time. It's also a city. It's really a town, 28,000 people, which is about 12,000-13,000 less than Teaneck, but we're a town. They call themselves a city. So it's a city that's been in decline for many years, economically depressed, many parts physically run down, with high unemployment, And that inspired the city council to act in 2000. In 2000, the city approved a development plan that would, and I quote from the decision, create in excess of 1,000 jobs. By the way, these phrases of the politicians, it's like not, they're not limited to any one time. It's every few months the same thing. So the plan would create 1,000 jobs, increase tax and other revenues, and revitalize an economically distressed city, including its downtown and waterfront areas. Among the inducements, Pfizer, for example, committed to building a $300 million research facility that would help rejuvenate the same area. There'd be new hotels, restaurants, businesses, a museum, and in one parcel, new homes, all of which would raise the tax base of the city. Now, it sounds like a classic case of eminent domain, the city condemning the property in order to redevelop it. But it wasn't, and here's the catch. The land was not taken over by the city. The land would be given, acquired by the city's development agent, from private homeowners, and then be given over to developers, in order to private developers, in order to develop that particular area. They would take the land from homeowners, buy from those who wanted to sell, and if they didn't want to sell, they would seize it for eminent domain and pay them compensation. But again, the catch here is the city wasn't taking over the property. The city was taking over for itself. The city was taking over the property in order to transfer it to private developers who would develop it and increase the city's tax base as a result of the businesses that were there. Suzette Kilo was among the plaintiffs who sued to stop the project. She lived in the Fort Trumbull section of town with a home she'd recently renovated that had a magnificent view of the water. She didn't want to move. And neither her property nor those of the other plaintiffs, her neighbors, were in a blighted area. The word blighted was used because that was a legacy of a prior case that said a city can condemn a blighted area in order to renovate it. Their homes in this area were in good condition in a residential zone that was simply desirable because it was located in the development area. They claimed that the seizure of their property was not for public use, as intended by the Fifth Amendment, because the land was not being used by the public. It was being transferred to private developers. In other words, the city was not seizing the land for the city, but for the use of private enterprise who would use that land in such a way that the city's tax revenue would increase. More money would be obtained from business than from the real property taxes the homeowners were paying. Kilo and her friends sued in Superior Court. They won. Then they lost in the state Supreme Court. The case was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court to determine whether or not eminent domain for the purpose of economic development of private individuals is considered public use under the Constitution. So what were the stakes? Here are the opening words of the oral argument. It's very interesting that today you're able to get this. Couldn't years ago. I listened to the oral argument in this case. You hear it online. It's exactly an hour. They're meticulous about time. You have both sides in the question. And the lawyer for Kilo started presenting to the court exactly what the issue was. He said, every home, church, or corner store would produce more tax revenue and jobs if it were a Costco, a shopping mall, or a private office building. There's no doubt Tina would make more money on my home if they put a 7-Eleven there. All right? But if that's the justification for the use of eminent domain, then any city can take property anywhere in its borders for any private use that might make more money than what is there now. That was his opening. And Justice O'Connor later on asked the respondent, the lawyer for New London, so if there's a Motel 6 and the city determined they would get more taxes from a Ritz-Carlton, they could just take it from one and give it to the other? And the answer was yes. Wow, that would be making new law. Well, this decision came down in 2005. It was, as typically in these cases, most recently, a 5-4 vote. Stevens, Kennedy, Souter, and the two Jews, Breyer and Ginsburg, voted for the city of New London against Rehnquist, Scalia, Thomas, and O'Connor. Justice Stevens wrote the majority opinion in favor of the city of New London. And he, of course, had to distance the court from the proposition this was purely a private benefit, which it sounds like, granted, there's a public benefit coming, accruing, incidentally, maybe even primarily, but it's incidental, the most money made by the private developers. Stevens wrote, "The city would no doubt be forbidden from taking petitioner's land for the purpose of conferring a private benefit on a particular private party." All right. This quotes an older case, Midkiff. "A purely private taking could not withstand the scrutiny of the public use requirement. It would serve no legitimate purpose of government and would thus be void." Of course, it's hard to imagine, though, any case where the city would condemn a particular property, give it to a private individual, without the city not having some residual benefit from that property, usually in the form of taxes, sometimes in the campaign contribution, but usually in taxes. Something would come out of it. Stevens continued, "Nor would the city be allowed to take property under the mere pretext of a public purpose when its actual purpose was to bestow a private benefit. The takings before us, however, would be executed pursuant to a carefully considered development plan." That's what Stevens said. But obviously, this was not a typical takings case where the land would be opened up to the public or its service available to the public. Rather, the issue was whether public use, here defined obviously as public purpose, includes this development plan. Here, Stevens and the majority were a little disingenuous, because the benefit was almost exclusively in terms of future tax revenue, but they persisted in seeing the overall need as part of the development plan. Using those words, which are code words, put this case squarely to their thinking in the tradition of another case, an older case, Berman versus Parker, 1954. There, the District of Columbia embarked on a slum renewal plan. Memo to D.C., it didn't work out. But nonetheless, in the 50s, they started a slum renewal plan, and they condemned poor Berman's department store. Berman had a department store in the neighborhood. The department store was in fine condition. He maintained it. It was a thriving business. But the city decided it would take that over, because right in the middle of the area, which they wanted to knock everything down. The court in Berman ruled unanimously that urban renewal was a classic public need, and that public use does mean public purpose, and the entire area needed redevelopment for any project to succeed and for the neighborhood to again flourish. Of course, the difference was the city then was managing the reconstruction and the renovation, not private people. Here in Kelo, the area in question wasn't one that suffered from blight, but rather was sufficiently distressed to justify a program of economic rejuvenation. Of course, you could say that about almost any area in the country. It always used more money. So that included more tax revenue, more jobs, and economic development, such that the court has to look at the overall plan and not simply its effect on individuals, especially individuals whose homes were not part of any blight. Now, the majority conceded that, I quote, "the government's pursuit of a public purpose will often benefit individual private parties. It's bound to happen. So why then could the government just not seize a Motel 6 to give it to a Ritz-Carlton?" There was no logical reason that was offered. Stevens wrote, "While such an unusual exercise of government power would certainly raise a suspicion that a private purpose was afoot, the hypothetical cases posited by petitioners can be confronted if and when they arise." That's a weak read, a very weak read, and it's the old politician's bluff. Ask him a tough question, he'll say, "Well, it's a hypothetical." Well, yeah, it's a hypothetical that naturally flows from the decision you're making. That's the natural consequence of this action, as O'Connor had pointed out. The only inhibition seems to be unpopularity in a democratic system. That is to say, the politicians do this too frequently, or to too many people, they'll be voted out. But if you do it to a small group of people, say disfavored people who don't have any political clout, doesn't matter. Well, unpopularity in a democratic system is not a constitutional doctrine. In truth, the court claimed to be following Connecticut law, in which the legislature had approved eminent domain driven by the need for economic development, but that alone should not have been material. The fact is, they could have ruled that law unconstitutional. Politicians always seek to accrue more power, and the responsibility of the courts is to rein them in. The mere fact that the legislature approved it should play no role if restrictions on eminent domain are to have any substance. The court acknowledged the hardship caused to plaintiffs, notwithstanding the just compensation, but found this to be a legitimate public taking. Well, the dissent had a field day. The dissent was very powerful. First, Justice O'Connor, quoting Justice Chase from 1798, "An act of the legislature, for I cannot call it a law, contrary to the great first principles of the social compact, cannot be considered a rightful exercise of legislative authority." A few instances will suffice to explain what I mean. This is again Chase in 1798. "A law that takes property from A and gives it to B, it is against all reason and justice for people to entrust the legislature with such powers, and therefore it cannot be presumed that they have done it." She wrote, "Today the court abandons this long-held basic limitation on government power, and by 5-4 vote, no less. Under the banner of economic development, all private property is now vulnerable to being taken and transferred to another private owner, so long as it might be upgraded, that is, given to an owner who will use it in a way that the legislature deems more beneficial to the public in the process." In effect, there's no longer any distinction between public and private use, because the court's loophole was so large that any use could conceivably have a public purpose, especially when we're talking about a greater tax base. She wrote, Justice O'Connor, "While the government may take their homes to build a road or a railroad or to eliminate a property use that harms the public, say petitioners, it cannot take their property for the private use of other owners simply because the new owners may make more productive use of the property." What about Berman? So she said, in Berman, a public purpose was realized when the blighted neighborhood was renovated, including the area of Berman's store. Side point, the courts are always loath to reverse, to overrule a precedent, because it makes the law seem haphazard and random, even more than it is. So therefore they try to fit all in a plan. So they could have, she says here, obviously, they could have maintained Berman and just ruled that Kelo was an impermissible extension. That's what she's saying here. See, here, Suzette Kelo's home was not blighted, nor was her neighborhood blighted. It was a tremendous area of land in which the residential homes were just one part of it. Their condemnation was simply a function of the developers wanting more prime land for their projects. Instead of having her home overlooking the water, build a condo overlooking the water. You make more money. In which case, no one's home or business is safe from government takeover. Again, quoting from Justice O'Connor, "For who among us can say she already makes the most productive or attractive possible use of her property? The specter of condemnation hangs over all property." And thinking back to the question she raised during the oral argument, she said, "Nothing is to prevent the state from replacing any Motel 6 with a Ritz-Carlton, any home with a shopping mall, or any farm with a factory." She dissented. In Clarence Thomas's dissent, so Justice Thomas, as we know, always cuts right to the chase, he wrote separately because he would have overruled Berman and overruled Midkiff as well. And he simply said that the court has rendered the public use clause of the Constitution a nullity, meaning it doesn't exist anymore. Even just compensation does not allow the government to simply take private property with no public use. And the simple shot in public use means public use. Roads, ferries, canals, railroads, public parks, otherwise known as something the public will use. Public use is something the public will use. Gee, how complicated can that be? He dissented as well. Unfortunately, they were in the minority. Now, there's a very interesting aftermath. Kelo and the others were forced to sell. Here's the clincher. The court had also rejected a suggestion that the standard applied in eminent domain cases should be a reasonable certainty that the anticipated benefits to the public will materialize. Well, here, in fact, the benefits never materialized. The land was seized. The project never got off the ground. The developer could not get financing. Kilo's house lay vacant 5 years after the decision, razed to the ground and not producing any tax revenue for the city. And Pfizer decided not to build its facility in New London. In the end, it was all for naught. What a disaster. The decision was a bad one with terrible repercussions, and they lost their home anyway. Several states have already adopted legislation protecting private property rights from the claws of government. And on the first anniversary of the Kilo decision in 1986, President Bush issued an executive order barring the federal government from eminent domain except for public use, which he defined as a purpose of benefiting the general public. Simple, as Justice Thomas had understood it. But of course, the federal government doesn't really exercise eminent domain that often over private property. Well, what does the Torah have to say about all this? It would demean and distort the Torah to describe its economics as capitalist or socialist. In fact, the Torah is its own system that borrows from both, but trends more, or I should say better, both borrow from it, but it trends more to a capitalist free enterprise system, as Rabbi Spira wrote today in the journal, with a built-in safety net for the poor. Tzedakah, Meiser, Leket, Chik, Chopeah, Shemitah, and especially Yovel. Hard to imagine the mandatory return of property in a purely capitalist system. And of course, that's because the purpose of the Torah is not to become rich, but to become holy. So income will always take a back seat to the pursuit of moral perfection. That being said, it's well established that private property, which is the bane of socialism, is respected and even celebrated in Torah life. Rav Kook wrote in Ein Ayom, in Masechta Shviyos, that the foundation of Torah law, Yisod HaTorah B'Mishpateha, Hi Hagbalat HaRechush V'Amadat HaTzedek B'Kinyan, is the limitation of property ownership and the upholding of justice in acquisitions, Kiim Mitnei Adam B'Mal Shalom, with property that's privately owned. That is to say, the acquisition of private property needs to be nurtured with a sense of generosity. You can only be generous, though, with something you own. It's easy to be generous with someone else's property. Right? That's why people sit around saying how much that guy should give to tzedakah. Be generous with someone else's property. So if the Torah wants us to develop good mitzvos, it can only be done with our property. Our property meaning property that we own. The Mishnah that he's commenting on, he appraises the person who pays his debts during the Shemitah year, even though Shemitah cancels all debts. Nonetheless, he should pay it back. Das Chachamim Noch, Uruch HaMoch HaMel. So pursuant to Torah law, anyone, man, woman, child, the righteous, the wicked, the Jew, the non-Jew, everyone is allowed to accumulate great sums of money and possessions. There's no prohibition to become wealthy. There's no limitation on the wealth a person can have. We don't say, as a certain president has, at a certain point, you have to say, I have enough. Torah doesn't maintain that. He can work alone, in partnership, form corporations. Person can buy whatever he wants and sell whatever he wants. The Torah does not even intrude on a person's acquisitive tastes, even when it could. For example, he can have as many servants as he wishes. Even the Chazal say, Marbe Avadim, Marbe Gozel, the more servants you have, the more theft you bring into your home. If a person acquires something on Shabbos, against the laws of Shabbos, the Kenyan is a good Kenyan, even though he sinned, because we don't want to interfere with commerce. There are limitations, many limitations, born of the halachic system. You can't traffic on Avodah Zarah, you can't sell land in Eretz Yisrael to anybody, but nothing detracts from the basic principle. The root of freedom is the capacity to work for yourself and to retain the fruits of your labor from the confiscation of outsiders. I mentioned a week and a half ago in Shul, Parshas Vayera, the first step to freedom was Makas Dam, the plague of blood, during which the Medrash says the Jews sold water to the Egyptians. So sold water. They could not get water any other way. Only sold. The Medrash says, Medrash Rabbah, it's the Tes Yud. If it was given away, if they gave it away, it would turn to blood. The Egyptians took it, it would turn to blood. If they sold it, it would be water. Mikan Heshiru Yisrael, the Medrash says. Thus the Jews become wealthy. They became wealthy here. What's the point? So my son Ari suggested the first step to psychological freedom. Because here now they were taking the place of their masters. Their masters, the Egyptians, had to provide everything to them. And now they're regaining their psychological equilibrium, a sense of chayrus, being masters to them, selling them water. But I thought something else related. The first step to economic freedom. The first step to freedom is really economic freedom. And here what the Torah did is turn them into entrepreneurs, selling a needed commodity to people who were desperate for it and keeping the profits. That's chayrus. That's how the Torah understands it. Mikan ha'ashir Yisrael. All that is true. Those who think ancient or modern Israel is one big kibbutz are in fantasy land. Vayeshev Yudav Yisrael Ovetach, Ish Tachas Gafno, Vetachas Teinasa, everybody sat under their own fig, their own vine. Everyone had the property they owned was theirs. They tended it. They gave what they had to the poor, but it was theirs. Land was divided amongst the tribes and to the families. The land was theirs. Socialism is an ideal, there's no doubt about it, and it had a certain hold on the world until it confronted reality. But Rav Kook writes, or at least implied, that the idea, this back in the 20s, the ideals of socialism can only be implemented through a capitalist system maintained by perfected people. So in fact, socialism itself, Rav Kook maintained, could never work, even though its ideals are grand. It could never work. The ideals could work through capitalist system if people are perfected. And Rav Hirsch writes, we know well, it's Devarim Tes Zayin test. Material prosperity only has meaning and importance as far as it serves to obtain and ensure right and morality. So in fact, capitalism, to some extent, lacks a moral dimension, but it can be infused with morality and humaneness, and that is what happens, or is supposed to happen, in the Torah framework. And Chazal did that regularly with special ordinances. Shul tin odelas bifnei lovin, not to, or they relax the laws of testimony in civil cases to encourage lending. Or takonas hashuk, a number of forms, someone who innocently buys stolen property has to be reimbursed when the original owner reclaims it. Otherwise, people are afraid to buy metaltalim, etc. So there's no doubt that under the laws of the Torah, private property is sacrosanct. And yet, the Torah also has what it calls din melech. There's a concept of eminent domain even under the laws of the Torah. In fact, Shmuel Hanavi warned the people against seeking a king, as he said in Shmuel Aleph Perches, Zeh Yemishpat HaMelech, this will be the law of the king, Hashem Locha Lechem will rule of you, Esfenechem Yikach, he'll take your sons, he'll take your daughters, Yisomol Merkavto, Parashav, Baratzul Lufnei Merkavto, he'll have them on his chariots, on run before him, V'esodoseichem, Eskamechem, V'zeiseichem HaTovim Yikach, V'nasam Levadov, he will seize your fields, your vineyards, your olive groves, the better ones among them, give it to his servants. Shmuel was trying to discourage them from having a king. So the king has prerogatives, conscription of people, and eminent domain over property. The Rambam codifies this in Hilchos Melachim Perek Dalid, V'lokeach ha-sados v'azaysim v'akramim l'avadov kishyachul ha-milchama. He could take the fields and the groves and the vineyards to four servants when they go to battle. The yif shetua mikomos eilu meim lahem mayochel misham. He can even take the whole thing. If they have nothing to eat, v'nosein demehem. He adds, the king has to pay compensation for it. But on what basis can the king seize property? Are there no limits as long as he pays just compensation? Not exactly. The Torah frowned greatly on expropriations that were not based on law or custom, and not for the purpose of war or some other pressing public need. So we know that Rambam writes in Hilchos Gzeila Perakei, the king can impose taxes as long as they're davar katzuv, a fixed amount, sounds like a flat tax. He can even decree forfeitures of private property for violations of laws, or seize the possessions of those that anger him. That's all part of Mishpat Melech, I guess coming from Amos Melech, the awe we have to have for a king. Klolo shel davar, kol din sheyachakok oso hamelech lakol, v'liyeh lo'odem echad bifnei asmo, eino gazel. Here's the principle. Any law that's fixed by the king and applies to all and does not target a specific person, that's not considered theft. But kol sheyikach meish zeh bilvad shelo kedas hayadu lakol, elo chamaseh zeh, anyone who takes from a particular person, not according to any known or established law, he just takes his property, that's considered chamos, that's robbery, harei zeh gozel, as they say in Brooklyn, gezel. That is theft. So it can't be arbitrary, can't be designated against a specific person. So what then was the problem of Achav and the vineyard of Navos and Yisraeli? Interesting, they will take it up in a few weeks. Achav took his vineyard, killed him in fact. Achav theoretically could have seized it, but when he sought to buy it and it was rebuffed, that's when he sinned, because he has the right to say no. Furthermore, very relevant to our case, the Haggos Maimoni writes in Hilchos Malachim, Perdal Achav, Achav gave the vineyard to his servants. He didn't keep it for himself. The king has no right just to take something from a person, a citizen, and give it to someone else. Well, the Ravaz says it wasn't during a time of war, and the king's powers of eminent domain are most critical in wartime in order to protect the whole kingdom. That wasn't this case. But just to seize someone's property in peacetime because he wants it, or he wants to give it to someone else, that can't be. Or the Gemara says in Baba Kamot, Daf Samach Amid Beis, Melech Poreis Lasos Lo Derech Vein Mochim Beyodo. A king can break through someone's field or home to build a highway that he needs. You can't stop him. That is to say, Lasos Lo Derech Ulu Uchlusim Shalo, Rashi says. The king can seize a field to build a highway for his people. But this is again a public need, and the property is being used by him and the people, not simply being turned over to someone else. So according to the Din Melech, though, this would seem to be a stretch. But there's another confiscatory power that is awarded Jewish authorities that is even more expansive than the king's power, and that's what is known as Hefker, based in Hefker. The Jewish court has the right to declare property ownerless, even if it technically has owners. They could just say, this is now officially ownerless. Gemara says, Yevamos da Petes and Beis, what's the source for it? Either from the decree of Ezra or a decree of Yeshua. There is a difference. Many Rishonim, like the Rashba, held this power as Daraisa, and this was the authority for all the Takanos mentioned earlier, the Tinaldelas and Takanos Ashuk, even if they negated some Torah right, even if they negated the Torah right permanently. This power is more than Harasha. That's one of the differences. Ezra's case was Harasha, but Yeshua's case was not. There, they were determining how to allocate the land of Israel. Whatever the Sanhedrin said, they did through Urim Batumim, but nonetheless, whatever was done was done. It means they have the right to declare, this property belongs to you, this belongs to someone else. The many ordinances that result from this principle of Hefker based in Hefker, that, for example, one acquires something within your four amos. Where does that come from? Because the Chazal determined within four amos, it's Hefker, belongs to you. Enforcing the words of a Shchiv Merah, does that mean writing? Someone on the brink of death says something, his verbal declaration has value. Ordering a husband to pay for a get, Hefker based in Hefker. Even the Prisbul, for example. Of course, the imposition of fines by based in the seizure of property which Kilayim is planted, even to take property from one, give it to another, they have that right. But even this is not completely capricious, but rather the powers must be rooted in some cause or justification. Of course, by the way, the mere fact that a based in does it means there are more decision makers involved than just the one king, and hence the power will be used more sparingly and hopefully more judiciously. Rama writes in his Shuvos, in Ayin Gimel, Dover Poshub. It's obvious. Shein Koch Latove Ho'ir Lesachin Dover Kiim Al Piadin Vamishpod. Obviously, there's no power for the leaders of the city to decree something based on law. I'm sorry, except based on law. They can't not operate with force with individuals. It's a very good phrase because it resonates through political theory. The majority has no right to coerce a minority. The majority cannot vote to dispossess a minority. That's, of course, a very meaningful phrase today from Ramah. It's especially very meaningful these days. You know, Jefferson said quite a number of years ago, almost two centuries and a decade ago, that democracy ends when the majority realizes it has the right to vote itself money out of the treasury. All right? That's basically the society we're living in today. We're perilously close to a situation when more than 50% of the people get some money from the government, in which case they are literally voting to take money out of the treasury that comes from the ones who don't get to give it to themselves. But people can't get together and vote and say this man has no rights or this man cannot have any property. The smart rights in Simon Beis Nechosh and Nishpatz of Kut Yudalov, the Chayn Kosov of Marik. Marik was really the original source for this. So even according to the ones who say that the rulers of the city, notice how they're called the Tovei Ha'ir, the good ones of the city, even though everyone said, according to those who say they have the right to ordain what they wish, it has to be some public need of the call. But to take money from one person, not for the purpose of the kehila, obviously they can't do that. Of course, therein lies the dilemma, because defining tzor hakol was a 5-4 decision here in Kilo. Assuming arguendo that broadening the tax base is a public need, so why couldn't they do it? The answer would have to be twofold. First, it's arbitrariness. Secondly, the part of the arbitrariness was the plan could easily have excluded this residential area, but for the fact that developers wanted it. You could add a third and fourth reason as well. It was not being taken over by the public, but by private individuals. So the Tzarech Kohol is very, very limited. And it was merely speculative in its realization. In the end, it didn't work out. So even Hefker based in Hefker has its limitations. Rav Menashe Klein writes in the Mishnah Lachos, Chelek Zayin, Siman Reish Alam Beis. It's a fairly long keta, but take just a minute or two. Umitchil Omer Ani, De'en Shum Koch Ba'olam Otsi Mama Mershus Bailam Beli Shum Si Balozeh. Lo Basin, Lo Melech, Lo Shum Ishacher. At first, he's discussing the rights of the courts here. No person has the power to take money from its owners without a reason. Not a Basin, not a Melech, no one. De Kol Shenitnu Lo Kadosh Baruch Hu Ukinao, Hareza Shalom. Anything that God gives a person, he acquires it, it belongs to that person. On what basis he take from this guy what God gave him? God can take it from him. That's the Pasuk in Iyov. Hashem Nasan, Hashem Lakach. Not only lies, it's property too. Omnam, Hecha Deyesh Siba, where there's a reason. Their basin can declare the property of owners ownerless, or to remove from him, and it's all based on the particular reason. He quotes the Marik, there's some reason for it. And now he quotes the Zichron Yehuda from Rabbi Yehuda, the son of the Rosh, that it really requires two separate situations in which this right of basin applies. One is where Bal HaMamon Asa Shlo Kehogen, the owner of the property, did something improper, and basin wants to fine him or to punish him. It's what they're allowed to do. He did something improper. Second, B'misha B'emes Lo Asa Avla. Second case where someone actually didn't do anything wrong. Amram Ro Basin Shetzarech Mipnei tikkun ha'olam lafkia mamono shel zeh, but based in source, some universal need, some public benefit that will accrue if they confiscate the money from this person. The dovar zeh hu kvar lav mistam hefker based in her, that is already more than just hefker based in hefker, because the hefker based in eino elo hafkir mono kol olam. Hefker based in means that the property owner is to everybody. Avo tikkun ha'olam, that's really a different societal mandate. What you need for the benefit of society, there is an even greater threshold of tikkun ha'olam, something that really benefit the society as a whole. In the end, what makes kilo such a difficult case is defining what is a legitimate siva or a legitimate sora. What's the reason? What's the need? As the halacha perceives it, the king would be more limited to based in, but nonetheless, if you wanted to, I guess you could squeeze into the halachic formula some justification for kilo. You could squeeze into it, or squeeze out of it. But the truth is, in law, it's much easier to justify than theory. It's very difficult to conjure a case in which the beis din would seize property from one person to give it to another who can manage it better, or make it more productive, or generate more taxes. They think about it. They have a field, and the aniyim are entitled to leka chit pampeh, or yes, the meiser from the field. And the court says, you know what? The kohen and the levim, they would get more out of this. The aniyim would get more out of this if the field was better managed. Let's take the field from this guy and give it to Archer or Midland Daniels. They'll run the field. Hard to imagine such a thing. Some fields produce better than others. Perhaps Rav Kook had the best way to resolve such disputes. He writes in his Trials and Truths in Aruch Mishpat, Choshen Mishpat Yud, everyone agrees that condemning private property for public use is reasonable. Shekol shirov hatzibur maskim im avad, ein lochush kol kachal tanak yichidim. As long as most of the tzibur agrees with the committee, you don't have to fear the arguments of individuals. Vayichidim ba'atzmam zo ki tovatam legrom tovo lechlav b'nei ha'moshava. And even the individuals, this is to their benefit that they cause some good to befall the moshava itself. Of course, he has to be reimbursed, cannot suffer any loss, but he cannot impede the benefit of the klal. Here, we're talking of the benefit was they wanted to widen the road in the moshav so it would encroach on some of the homeowner's private property, but make it easier for everyone else, both the people living there and others getting in and out. The owners protested. Rav Kook said, no, it's mutter, but there's a democratic way of doing it, and that is have the Vod vote, have the people vote. That's what happened here. Rather than relying on unelected judges in black robes. Now, there's another case, which is also interesting to mention. Rav Sternbuch has a case in Chuvos von Hagos, Gimel Tuf, son of Zion. All the tenants in a building had agreed to vacate in order to allow the building to be demolished and apartments built there, new apartments. Except for one fellow who had a misrad katan, guy had a little office in a closet, and he refused to be vacated except for an exorbitant sum of money. Everyone else was bought out, alright? His closet was not worth that much, so he wanted an exorbitant sum. They refused to pay. Rav Sherbach ruled that he cannot hold it up. They should offer fair compensation, plus a little more, pitzuyim, but not what he wants. He says the greater good prevails, majority rules, and this applies even if a secular court rules in his favor. We don't learn morality from them. But here's the critical difference. Here the affected parties were all in the same position. They're not outsiders or strangers or developers who would benefit. Everyone in the building has the right to vote. That's the whole basis of condo law, even in halacha. If a condominium, people vote. You got to go by the majority rule. Even if the majority rule encroaches on some of your rights, because that's how democracy works. You have to follow the road. Here, Kilo's house was taken from her only because the ruling body presumed that others would put it to more productive uses. Well, since then, 42 states have enacted legislation that in some way negates the effects of the Kelo decision and protects property rights, private property rights. I don't think New Jersey is one of those states now. For all I know, there could be a 7-Eleven on my home property right now. But a related issue, of course, will be before the court next month, the Obamacare case. What are the limits to the federal government's authority to impose on private citizens the obligation to buy private health insurance? Can the government mandate that? Like, can they mandate you to buy anything else? So far, no. After June, when the decision comes down, expect another 5-4 decision? Who knows? But the Kelo, we would say, as Rabbi Skewer wrote in today's Wall Street Journal, the right to be an owner, to be an entrepreneur, to be a capitalist, is fundamental to being a free, creative, personally responsible, productive human being. Let not government squelch or strangle that right because of its misguided schemes or rapacious ways, because that right comes from the Creator himself. Thank you very much.